Airing on Asheville FM in Asheville, this is The Final Straw Radio, a weekly anarchist and anti-authoritarian broadcasts and podcast emanating out of occupied Chalagi land in southern Appalachia. We bring you voices and perspectives from projects and struggles all around the world, and you can find our archives, transcripts, ways to follow us and support us at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. This week on the show, we're starting out with an interview with Lo and Megan, two supporters of Jewish independent journalist, artist, and anti-fascist leftist from Albany, New York, Alex Stokes Kontumpassis. Alex is serving a 20-year sentence for defending himself and three other community members attacked by Proud Boys and Oath Keepers at the New York State Capitol on January 6th of 2021. Here we speak with Lo and Megan, two friends and supporters of Alex, who talk about Alex's media work, the politically charged court case, and his ongoing appeal. More on his case can be found at freealexstokes.com. Then you'll hear from our comrades at Frequenza in so-called Germany with a recent interview of Anya of the grassroots group Solidarity Zone, which offers legal, media, and other support to folks facing charges of anti-war direct actions inside of Russia, to speak about their work in the case of Ruslan Siddiqui, an anarchist who does not deny the charges of railway sabotage against the Russian war efforts against Ukraine. You can find their Telegram or Facebook accounts either by solidarity_zone on Telegram or on Facebook at facebook.com/solidaritizone. Finally, you'll hear Sean Swain reading from an incomplete list of people killed by law enforcement in the USA during the month of April 2023.
Hi, I'm Megan, she, her. I am from Albany, New York, and I'm a family friend of Alex Stokes. I know his whole family.
My name is Lo. I go by they, them. I am an advocate for Alex and happy to be a part of the Free Alex Stokes Project. And I'm also in Albany.
Would you tell us a bit about Alex, like his personality, his passions, his work? I mean, it sounds like y'all have known him for a while. So any sort of stuff to help sort of ground the audience in a sense of who this person is that we're going to be talking about.
He's an artist, a musician, a poet, writer. He has a passion for social justice and equality. And he's somebody who was very prominent in his community and did a lot of work for the community, whether it was, you know, the Red Bookshelf or the Albany Victory Gardens or different organizations like that, that he was a part of before his incarceration.
He did a lot of freelance or independent journalism. He had his own public access channel television show, and he set up the news, and he would go around Albany recording lots of local events. And he named the program after his family's business. So it was News World Albany Banana Corps, since his father was a banana middleman for many years.
They used to have a market, and it was many generations.
That's cool.
Through that market.
Yeah. There's an episode that is up on the support site that listeners can watch a YouTube link to. That's a
montage.
Really...
Yes. We have several, like, you know, original episodes that he broadcasts himself. So
oh,
you can
cool.
go through that through the site. But there is the 7-year highlights reel. So that is actually across, yeah, the 7 years of his filming.
That's
kind
incredible.
Of smooshed into a good 40-minute video.
This is going to sound weird, but could you describe what cable access is to folks? Because there might be a generational gap where some people are like, I'm not familiar with this.
I realize that, yes, there's a generational gap. My kids call it live TV because you used to only be able to watch TV when it was on. And there was something called public access where you could, there would be like on channel 3 or channel 4 or something like that, where it would just be a block of time and people could buy up those hours and then, you know, publicize whatever they wanted on that their own TV hours. So sometimes you would see lots of talk shows before there were independent podcasts. It would be on a public access TV. Ours in Albany was located in the basement of the Albany Public Library.
Yeah, that's cool. I mean, it takes a lot of effort to produce just like an audio thing like this show, but producing video, going out, recording clips, editing them, being in studio and recording a live segment with someone else doing commentary, that's a lot of work for someone to put in. So the fact that he was doing it over 7 years to inform the community around social justice issue, like, really says a lot, I think, about his personality. It's pretty funny, too.
After watching, yes, they are very funny. You know, watching several of them over the summer, I just said it was like a love letter to Albany. Yeah. Like, you can just tell how much he loves this town. The fact that he's walking all over the place filming it.
Yeah. Can you talk a bit about the Proud Boys and other far-right groups who showed up in Albany on January 6th, 2021? What was known about what was happening in other places? What had groups like Proud Boys done before in Albany? And what do you know about Alex's prior relationship to them as a media maker or an activist, I guess, in the community?
Well, on that day, they were basically under the umbrella of the Uncle Sam Proud Boys, which at the time was a chapter out of Troy, New York. And it was a Stop the Steal rally that day, just like all the other capital cities, as we found out later. It was a coordinated effort by the Proud Boys all over the country. And, you know, the Proud Boys were kind of, they were looked at as the security, essentially, for the Oath Keepers and the 1776ers that were at the Stop the Steal rally. So that was kind of like their role, especially that day. And, you know, I mean, there had been problems before in Troy, at certain like protests in Troy. I mean, Albany was kind of like a different battleground, I guess you could say. So he had been just like learning that they were, you know, as we all know, that they're very dangerous people. And he was just trying to be there in case he needed to keep people safe.
Like, I know that, as you said, like this sort of thing was happening in places all around the country. Like, all eyes were on DC, but groups were showing up or had threatened to show up in capitals around the country. And there was like a major fear that there was going to be some sort of coup d'etat, some sort of like coordinated mass violence that was going to occur. And so, to your knowledge, was Alex showing up as a media personality to cover this, as a community activist or some other capacity? And could you explain what happened to him there?
He was there as both a community member and as a journalist. He had been taking pictures that day, and there was a Black counter protester there who had his hands in his pockets the whole time. And there was a verbal exchange between him and a Proud Boy. And this particular Proud Boy was the initial aggressor, and he took out an illegal grade taser and tased this man in the neck because he felt threatened. And then a melee broke out, and different MAGA people, Proud Boys, it was kind of like a whole just bunch of people that were beating up the counter protesters to that Stop the Steal rally. And Alex, you know, he intervened, and he had to, in that situation, in self-defense and the defense of others, around him, he had to use extraordinary measures, unfortunately. And he was just trying to, again, keep people safe, make sure everybody survived. It was a really, really bad attack on their part. It's crazy how these things go sometimes. It lasted about, what, 45 seconds?
It was so fast.
It was so fast. However, there was a special agent there, and she hid behind a tree. She didn't intervene at all. It was kind of like just everybody at the protest was kind of like there without any other types of law enforcement present. They were nowhere in East Capitol Park. We found out later that they had been on the perimeter of East Capitol Park, but they were not actually present until after the incident had happened. Kevin Metcalf, he's a journalist, an independent journalist in Canada. He put together a really great slideshow of what happened. He took video from, you know, the two towers from that day. There was like a north and south tower, and he combined the video together to show exactly what happened piece by piece. And yeah, I mean, there were Proud Boys that got hurt. And then Alex, a few minutes later, was arrested. But the Proud Boys that day were not searched. They weren't charged with anything. It was basically like, okay, you're free to go. Let's just let you go. And the two people who had injuries, the two Proud Boys who had injuries, ended up going to the hospital.
I absolutely understand somebody having to intervene to stop violence. And supposedly that's what the police are supposed to do in this sort of situation, right? Not just stand by the side and then like pick off people after damage has been done. How serious were the injuries to the people who got hospitalized?
There was one Proud Boy who he got injured and was out that night. there was another Proud Boy, the one who had been beating Alex into the concrete, and he also broke Alex's wrist. This Proud Boy had injuries to his abdomen, and it did take him some more time to recover. But, you know, after about 6 weeks, he was back to being an EMT doing 12-hour shifts.
Yeah. I mean, the injury was significant, and it's true, had it been left untreated, it would have caused probably death. But he was treated and back and working as an EMT, according to his own testimony, about 6 weeks later, the following month.
Each instance throughout the melee, because I know it can be a little bit hard to follow, the Proud Boys were the initial aggressors every time, every single time. They were causing the harm to the counter-protesters that were there.
Yeah, and I mean, if as you said, like, Alex was being pounded into the concrete by this individual, for someone to defend themselves in order to stop that violence seems pretty reasonable. You said that Alex was arrested after the melee was broken up or broke up. Can you talk about Alex's experience after January 6th as a defendant, as a survivor of violence, as a public individual and a journalist? And what was his trial like?
It was rough.
It was rough. It was a very intense, extremely intense experience.
First of all, the press just went wild with it and called him like an Antifa stabber, basically, and just grabbed some screenshots or whatever from his social media posts and just really tried to play him up as a really big, dangerous guy, which is just, it's kind of laughable. They, you know, I do want to say I've known Alex since he was 12 years old. He's been carrying a knife in his pocket for 20 years. So they really wanted to make a big deal that there must have been intent for him to bring a knife there. He had a knife. He probably had his wallet. He was probably wearing socks, just like any other day out. It was, my uncle has carried a knife with him for 40 years. And it's something, in my personal opinion, that lots of people who work with their hands often have these small little tools on them. It was a pocket knife.
Yeah, it was 2 to 3 inches.
Yeah, so within the legal limit, like not long enough to be able to stab someone in the heart, that's generally the measure of it, is like, you know, 3 to 4 inches. And also, like, does Alex have a history of stabbing people?
He did not have any type of record like that whatsoever. Yeah. He went 7 years doing this type of work with no documented or recorded incidences at all.
But yeah, the press tore him apart and then kind of dropped the story because the trial didn't happen for another year and a half.
And all throughout this time, he was under gag orders, which I don't know if that's necessarily been talked about a lot. And that's actually what happened right before his trial. He was under a gag order that he wasn't aware of. And he had done a podcast with Ian Higgins. And, you know, they tried to put him in jail because of that podcast before his trial. It was a couple weeks before his trial. I think it was September of 2022. Mm-hmm. And he thought he was fine. He didn't know. And, you know, I mean, I kind of interpreted that as like the prosecutors wanted a certain optics, right? You know, it looks different when you walk into court from your home in a suit than it does if you're coming from jail in a jumpsuit. So, I mean, those kinds of incidences peppered his trial. It was just constant, like, okay, what bad thing is going to happen next? How is this going to go wrong next? And it was brutal. There were times where it was just like brutal.
The way that the support site talks about, the way that the media had talked about Alex beforehand, is almost like when someone is injured by the police and it becomes public knowledge, the media oftentimes gets a bunch of information from the police department saying that this person was caught smoking pot once, and this one neighbor of theirs says that they don't like them, and it's just sort of like tearing the individual apart. And the support site talks about how they went back through his social media and we're making accusations of like intent towards violence and extremist ideology. Is there any of that you can talk about a little bit?
I mean, yeah, it came up at the trial. They literally used his social media posts to say that it was intentional, that this was his plan all along, that he was filled with rage and hate, and that this was his big, great plan to stab two people once a fight broke out that he didn't start and that was going to be heavily recorded based on its location.
These were memes that many liberals were sharing, leftists were sharing. I mean, these memes were being shared all over the country by thousands of people at the time. And there was one point where I can't guarantee that this was actually the case, but it almost seemed as if the judge thought Alex invented mm-hmm. the meme. And he went on this whole thing about the sanctity of Bugs Bunny and how dare the defendant do this. It was like along those lines. It was just, I mean, that's how this went. That's how this went.
Was it one of the like Bugs Bunnies in a tuxedo and doing this?
Yes.
And okay. Yeah. No, I mean, yeah. It's important to stand up for the sanctity of Bugs Bunny in that situation, I think.
Yeah. And he didn't create it.
No.
Either.
Right.
How long did the trial last and what was he convicted of and sentenced to?
All right. It was technically just 3 days of actual trial piece. There was one day of jury selection in the beginning, and then the sentencing was on Friday, which took about half a day for the jury to deliberate.
They actually did it during a working lunch. We went out to lunch because we thought we had time. It was literally a 5-minute walk down the street, and we weren't able to even, we had to leave right away because they had a verdict so fast. Yeah. You know, it was, at the time, it was assault in the first degree, attempted assault in the first degree, assault in the second degree, attempted assault in the second degree, and
possession of a weapon.
That was carried over from the thing we were talking about earlier. But, you know, during sentencing, the attempteds got...
They're considered lesser charges.
Yeah,
the attempteds were not considered in sentencing.
Yes.
But he got a consecutive sentence. So he was sentenced to 12 years for assault one and then 8 years for assault two.
And then with 5 years parole, so, if, you know, he's 40 years old. So if you do the math, that means all of this would end theoretically when he's 65, which is, yeah. You know, retirement age. So,
yeah, there was nothing mandating this length of sentence. While it does fall under the guidelines and it's not the maximum, the judge absolutely chose to sentence him consecutively. And people, like, is it compared to other things? You can use your vehicle to kill somebody and they're not coming back. That is permanent damage and get less than 20 years.
Yeah, and as you've pointed out, this is a clear instance of somebody interceding when violence was already occurring in order to stop the violence from occurring. Were there any convictions of folks from the Proud Boy or other groups that were present there? I mean, sometimes I've seen where a prosecutor will try to make a both sides approach towards altercations and go after members of the right and then pick up some people on the left too, just to say, like, look, we're not biased against you. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you saw around the same time here or?
No, not at all.
It's trying.
Unfortunately. I mean, there were two incidences like that, but they definitely did not have the same weight. So the first one was an individual who was kind of like a MAGA guy. He was the only one that got searched and arrested that day. He hit one of the counter protesters in the eye with a flagpole, almost poked her eye out, actually. And then the initial aggressor, Proud Boy with the taser, he was identified 2 months later by a coworker. And I think he served 30 days of community service. And that was about it.
Yeah. And it was an illegal taser at the time in New York State. It was police grade, so it wasn't even something that he could have picked up on a nice drive to Vermont.
As opposed to the perfectly street legal, like, knife that somebody had in their pocket that is a tool.
I bought one at a gas station in anticipation of this interview, just to prove my point.
This is the Final Straw Radio, and you're hearing our interview with supporters of Alex Stokes, an anti-fascist journalist from Albany, New York, serving a 20-year sentence for self-defense from January 6th, 2021. Can you speak about some of the other people that were arrested on January 6th in Albany, who they were and what happened to them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so on the scene, the man with the pole on the MAGA side who hit the woman was arrested on the scene and later released. And then the two people that were attacked, the man who was tased in the neck and the black man who had at least up to three guys jumping on him at once, They were arrested on the scene as well. Also, one activist was arrested after he showed up after the whole event was over. And they said he walked past the tape or something like that. But he was roughed up by the police. Like, his whole face was bruised and scuffed up. He said that they put a knee on the back of his neck during this.
Dang, that's pretty crazy. Did those folks get charges pressed against them and have to do any time for what happened? Or for the person who got attacked, as you mentioned, who was tased, or the person who allegedly went into an area of investigation past the tape or whatever?
Right. I think that all the charges were basically ACOD'd, which is a delayed dismissal, a German in contemplation of dismissal. So basically, eventually the charges were dismissed. I'm not 100% sure on all of those cases how they were resolved, but I think it did involve ACODs. For the most part, I can't imagine how traumatic it must have been to be attacked and then be arrested for after you were the one who was attacked. Just really wanted to mention that the cops arrested all the black people when they finally showed up.
Yeah. Yeah. And roughed them up, as you said, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Like in the Albany proper video, there's a documentation of it's Lexis Figueroa.
The one from the two different towers that you mentioned? Or that was mentioned. There was video from one tower, one corner of the park, and video from another, and they were sort of syncretized to show what happened throughout the protest. Yeah,
I don't think the jury saw anything about the aftermath of what happened there. There was an article by an independent newspaper that kind of detailed what Lex accused the police of and had a photo of him that he was really marked up from it. He was the one who walked past the tape or whatever, who wasn't there for any of the incident.
Yeah, I mean, probably a case of police just, being racist, but also, trying to do the both sides thing. So nobody died on this day in Albany, thank goodness. At least two people died, including one protester and one law enforcement officer in D.C. Mm-hmm. Can you talk, different jurisdiction, obviously, different prison system, different judges. But do you have any comparisons to prosecutions for folks that were convicted in D.C. at the time? Like Terrio, who led the Proud Boys.
Enrique got 22.
Oh, he did. Okay.
Yeah. So that's another thing, too, that people within our friend group and other people who are hearing Alex's story have kind of, they don't really understand. They're very confused by, especially if they know Alex very well. Enrique Terrio got 22 years and 3 years parole. And so it's almost like there's this crazy false equivalency that develops somehow. And it's beyond comprehension to us. Like, we don't know how this happened. It's kind of like a nightmare. But, it doesn't make sense to us how that could have happened. I mean, Enrique Terrio is he was tried as a terrorist. So,
yeah, and it seems like they did this last effort to just say, and he's just as bad. Like, I felt like there was this false equivalency that Alex is just this left-wing proud boy, and here's his social media or something. But he wasn't a member of any organization. He certainly, his ideology is to help people, and he was just always afraid of somebody getting hurt at one of these things.
Just always wanted to make sure everybody was safe and, because everybody has the right to protest.
And, in his own videos, I don't see him threatening the cops or pointing weapons at them or anything like that. Like, he seemed to be able to get along with everybody and move through really contentious crowds.
Does Alex have any legal steps available to him at this point, short of pardon or a commutation?
He does.
We have good news.
Yes. He has an appeal that is probably going to be completed and submitted by the time you submit your interview. Okay. It's that close to being done. And it's a very strong appeal. We're hopeful. And there are a few ways that he could, quote unquote, win. The first, obviously, we want the dismissal. That would be amazing. But we also know how rare that is in this country, especially at this time, in 2024. Then the other two options could be the 12-year sentence gets knocked off, then he serves the full 8, or vice versa. And then parole would be reduced if that happened too. It wouldn't totally go away, but it'd be reduced. And then what is looking like might happen is a new trial, which, you know, everything would start all over again. Bail would start all over again. You know, trial dates would start all over again. The plea would happen again. So we would just, it's too hard to tell right now exactly how the third appellate in New York State wants to approach or wants to tackle this, but we're almost there.
That's great.
It's exciting. Like, yeah, like you said, almost there. Like, we'll know this time a year from now, we'll have answers at least. And it looks like at some point in the second half of this year, you'll hear more about the appeal and the answers to it. I know everyone wants to see the everything. People want to read the transcripts, and I understand that, but not yet. You just got to wait until like this is actually, the judges have to look at it first.
Yeah. What's the appeal based on? Is it based on the like an unfair sentencing? Is it based on withholding of evidence, the jury handling, or can you talk about that?
How about all of those?
Okay.
So there are 8 points, and that's all I can really go into. I guess I could give you a comparison from what I understand, and I'm totally new to this. I had to like learn everything really fast. From what I understand, usually an appeal has 2 to 3 what they call merits or like sections. This one has 8. So that just gives you an idea of what happened during trial and what happened preceding trial.
Cool. That's really great news that I was not expecting. And I
thank everyone who has contributed to his legal fund. It has been super vital. And Alex, thanks you. And we're very appreciative of everyone who has like bought prints, who's donated. It's seriously been essential.
Thanks to the International Anti-Fascist Defense Fund because they advertised Alex's case.
Oh, that's
great. Really helped a lot too.
I assume you're still fundraising because this is like an uphill battle from here and everything restarted. So Alex is quite an accomplished painter. You mentioned that he's an artist before. Can you talk about those, the print fundraiser project and what that entails, some of the images that are on there, et cetera?
Sure. Yeah. They're people that have influenced Alex throughout his life, whether they were, you know, civil rights people or musicians or, you know, people who, you know, stood up and resisted, basically.
Yeah. We don't know why we said 3,000. I don't know. It seemed like
a good number at the time.
We were very stressed.
Yeah.
I was curious, and we looked up Heather Heyer is his best-selling portrait.
That's a good painting.
Absolutely. Prince gets a lot of views as well. He's in second place.
He put so much for people who, you know, have been close to Alex throughout the years. You know, they know how much emotion he put into the Heather Heyer one, especially because like what often didn't get talked about, actually what didn't get talked about at trial at all is his work, as we said, but also the experiences that he had doing that work. I mean, he was there as Heather Heyer died, like he watched her die, you know, and then he created this, you know, beautiful, you know, portrait of her. And, you know, just stuff like that was never really discussed. And a lot of it, you know, they tried to keep it not political, as they said, even though the judge did, I think it was a 10-minute political speech at the end of everything. And it was in the newspaper, too. So everybody saw that he talked in a political way at the end. They weren't allowed to say certain words. They weren't allowed to say certain phrases. His trial lawyer, Jasper Mills, was very limited in what he could do for Alex in certain situations. And they tried to focus on the really like on the violence instead of like the day, instead of the circumstances, stuff like that.
I mean, with this upcoming appeal, then it sounds like that's probably where the next question is going to be. What is the support project working on right now? That's clearly you've answered that question, that this is like the next big thing. I guess what can, besides contributing to the fundraiser, buying those prints, what are some ways that people in the listening audience can support Alex and those of you that are supporting Alex through this right now?
I mean, writing letters to him. he loves receiving mail. don't know if you can think of anything else.
Reading them. There's, you know, lots of local organizations in Albany that Alex supported. And these are like organizations that were primarily directed at helping people immediately. And if you want to support Albany Victory Gardens or the Red Bookshelf or Community Matters 518 or your own local Black Lives Matter activists, that would be huge. You know, here's a story about Alex that I like sharing, and that I like to say, lots of us can say Black Lives Matter, but Alex helped carry the hospital bed up to the second floor apartment of a young man who was shot and paralyzed by the Albany police. So he does things like, just, he will help you. Hospital beds are heavy. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Can you talk a little bit? I know it's kind of off, slightly off topic maybe, but can you talk a little bit about the gardens, the Victory Garden? I don't know if you know the history of it or not.
Sure. I mean, it was started by Greg and Jody Sheldon, and it's urban gardening, okay. And it provides food for the people of that community in Albany. During the height of the pandemic, Alex was somebody who delivered that food.
Yeah, he kept that going up himself.
Yeah. And they later, you know, it's sometimes I look back and I'm like, how did this happen? Like, he, in between January 6th and his trial, he won an award with them for Albany Victory Gardens. He won an award from the mayor of
Rensselaer
for his artwork. I mean, you know.
He had, I think, 21 letters of support after his conviction before his sentencing. They were from organizers, business owners, a bunch of professionals.
All walks of life, which I think, if I had to guess, I saw the look on the face of one of the prosecutors. And she looked very surprised. She was like holding the letters in her hand. She kind of looked up like, oh, like it just was not what she was expecting at all. I mean, it was a folder full of support.
That's amazing. I guess to jump back to the letter writing, for folks that are considering writing to Alex, are there any subjects that they should maybe hold back from talking about? Are there things that Alex likes talking about in particular, like areas of interest that they could really engage him in the letter writing process? Any of that sort of stuff?
I mean, well, he has varied interests, but
varied interests. I'd say that, A, we linked right on the website the instructions from the New York State Correctional Services about what not to do and how to send the mail. And there is a limit of how many pages for that. He likes news. He likes history. I don't know how much they're selecting from different news articles and whatnot, or how much that's censored. Comics. He loves those. He likes lots of science and popular mechanics types of articles.
And he's teaching himself how to play guitar in there. Okay. He was able to order a guitar, and he was teaching himself how to play harmonica. So he loves receiving, you know, blues songs in the mail, you know, different things like that, or like rock songs, you know, just, you know, kind of all over the map. And just to let you know, the website is, for those of you out there who might not have seen it yet, it's freealexstokes.com. And it has a lot of different, if you have any questions, you can pretty much go throughout the website and kind of like get the questions answered.
Yeah. You can contact us through the website.
Cool. Okay. Well, was there anything that I didn't ask about that you wanted to talk about? Anything that I didn't cover that's like occurring to you that you want to get out in this chat?
I don't know. I want to say that Alex has never really misrepresented himself. Like, I think that there's been a lot of those allegations directly from the district attorneys, as well as just the assumptions in the media. But he's always just been really just acting as himself. He was involved in these causes because he cares about people. You know, his supporters are nonviolent people themselves. We all have day jobs. And I think it's really important to share his story. I think while there's definitely some factors about this that make it a little special. When it comes down to the legal system, it really just railroads everybody, and it doesn't care about what your situation was at the time. They will look for the worst of it. They will overcharge you. You will get the option of a really shitty plea deal or worse.
I think the one thing that people on all sides have been able to kind of bond over, or they've all had the same question, they don't understand the sentence. They don't understand the 20 years. That confuses everybody. They're like, how could this have happened? How did this happen? And I remember at first people were like, well, isn't this the capital of New York? And aren't we in New York? And they just didn't understand why this happened the way it did.
Yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous and also scary. And I'm really glad that he's getting this retrial. As scary as that is to have to go through all those steps again.
Well, we're hoping. I mean, we don't know what's going to happen yet, but yeah.
Please share his story.
Well, thank you so much, both of you, for talking and for taking the time. And yeah, good luck. Fingers crossed.
Thank you, and thank you for amplifying his story. We really appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is huge. We're excited. Thank you.
This is the Final Straw Radio, and you heard our interview with supporters of Alex Stokes. Next up, comrades from Frequenza interviewed Anya of Solidarity Zone about the case of Ruslan Siddiqui, an anarchist imprisoned in Russia, accused of railway sabotage against the Russian war on Ukraine.
Hi, first of all, thank you that you were finding time to talk with us. Maybe you can introduce yourself as you like, with your preferred name, pronoun, and affiliation, which makes sense to our talk today.
I'm Anya, member of a group called Solidarity Zone.
If you can tell a little bit to those who don't know, what is Solidarity Zone?
Solidarity Zone is a grassroots initiative that provides legal and humanitarian and media help to those arrested for anti-war direct action in Russia. It can be setting fire on administrative buildings and military recruitment offices. It can be railroad sabotage and similar actions against Russian war machine and government itself. We appeared firstly as a group of friends who already, each of us was involved in prisoner support before full-scale invasion into Ukraine. After 24th of February 2022, we noticed in the news that some actions, anti-war actions, are not matching criteria of support of liberal human rights organizations. They didn't organize defense of persons who committed radical actions against war. And firstly, we decided just like informal group to defend several people that we found in pretrial detention centers. And then more such cases appeared, and we realized that we need to call ourselves somehow and create social media accounts to spread the word about prisoners, about kind of protest, because it's, on the one hand, it's pretty idealized by different groups, actually.
Yeah, thanks for this brief explanation about what Solidarity Zone is doing. Hello from my side as well. Today we wanted to specifically talk about the case of Ruslan Siddiqui. Maybe you can first of all explain to our listeners what the case is about.
We know this case because a friend of Ruslan sent us mail with information about his arrest. After that, we sent a lawyer to Ruslan, and through the lawyer asked him to tell us a bit more about his case and about his position. After that, we, together with Ruslan and his friends who contacted us, decided to organize his support together. Ruslan is accused, and he doesn't deny these accusations. He derailed 19 carriages of cargo train in Rizan region. He made self-made explosives in two spots on the railway and watched it through the camera he installed near the railroad. He was waiting when cargo train, military supply train will pass this part of railway and then to blow the rails and derail the train. Actually, his plan was to destroy the rails and stop for some time moving of military supply trains. But the train which was derailed by Ruslan wasn't used by Russian military. Yeah, but anyway, this part of railroad was destroyed and the damage, according to Russian railway company, was named like 30 millions rubles. And yeah, it took time to restore the moving of cargo trains in this part. And also pro-governmental media wrote after Ruslan's arrest that he organized also a drone attack on a military airport from where aircrafts going to like to provide the bombs for Russian military in Ukraine. But officially, this case not yet begun, and the accusation wasn't yet official.
So that means it was only published on the media. He didn't receive any formal accusation about the airbase case so far.
Yeah, but we, I think we should wait, because sometimes pro-governmental media publish something that then appears in criminal case. So we can't, unfortunately, say that it wasn't in near future. Wouldn't be.
Maybe you can say some more words. From my point of view, it's like quite strong position to don't deny that the accusations about the derailment. Is it because of that there's that much evidence that he's not able to deny it anyway? Or is it also kind of a political position that he is like, say, that's really like this kind of actions is something, I don't know, he can stand for, or because of its ideology or his beliefs or whatever?
I can't say for sure, but I think it's mostly about position. In any case, where we support people, because in several cases, actually, persons who are like under the trial now, they are from the very beginning of their case, they decide to be agree with actions they did. Yeah, and I think in the case of Ruslan, it should be same. But also, maybe it's important to say that it can be several hours between real arrest of a person and kind of official arrest. And this time, very often used by security service, like FSB or cops for torturing people, for beating them to get some proper like words, witnessing against themselves. And I think it can be also part of the reason why people sign in documents with accusations.
Talking about the political perspective, you didn't mention it, but as it's written in different articles, Ruslan is an anarchist. And does he also do some statements now out of prison?
Yeah, we know from Ruslan's friends that he's anarchist. He's have actually a lot of interests that can be topics for letters to him. Yeah, but we didn't establish strong contact with him, so we are not yet in letter exchange. It was just more technical visits of lawyers. So for now, we can say very little about his political views, about something more about his personality. But I think it should be possible possible, maybe during the so-called investigation, because first time when Ruslan facing the most pressure from security services, from prison staff, and in other cases, we see that after several months of detention, it becomes easier and it starts to be possible to ask lawyer to talk with prisoner, to ask him or her about interests, about political statements or something that a person would like to spread outside of prison.
What is, by now, with the accusation which Ruslan has already officially, what does it mean? How many years of imprisonment he can get?
He's accused on two articles. It's always difficult for me to count years. I guess up to 20, because the first one is terrorist act, and second one is keeping explosives.
Also, in several languages in the articles about the case, people can also find an address to write letters to Ruslan. At the same time, there is this relatively new law, which is making it problematic or nearly illegal to communicate with foreigners, because this could be counted as a traitorship of the country. Does it still make sense for people who are not in Russia to write letters for political prisoners?
Sorry, I didn't understand, which law do you mean? About confidential...
Yeah, confidential interactions with foreigners, which can be also problematic. Make it illegal to communicate.
I guess this law mostly done for people who are free, to make more criminal cases. But I don't know about, I can't remember if somebody between prisoners even mentioned that.
So from your perspective, it is still makes sense to write letters?
Of course, but the only point here is that censorship in Russian prisons allows only letters in Russian, so you need to use online translator or to ask someone who speaks Russian to translate the letter, and there are a couple of services that still quite good working with foreign telephone numbers, foreign bank accounts, like prison mail, and a bit more complicated for Zona Telecom. These two services is possible to use from outside of Russia.
Right. Apart writing letters, is there other opportunities to support Ruslan and or your work as Solidarity Soon?
Now there is maybe easiest possibility to support Ruslan directly is to donate for the work of his lawyer, because right now we are running a fundraiser for lawyer. Yeah, and if here maybe a question about importance of legal defense in Russia now, the most important for us as a group is to have a connection with person in prison without censorship and possibility to organize maybe sometimes not really legal, but kind of solidarity and showing that a person isn't left alone. Yeah, emotional support. Also, good lawyer is only possibility to tell to outside of prison about tortures, about bad conditions. Yeah, because it's a really common thing that prison staff maybe don't do something directly against political prisoners, but just putting them in such living conditions when, for example, there is no part of glass in the window and the winter starting, and doing such things that make their life more difficult.
Is there anything else you think is important to say as about the case of Ruslan or about your work in general, or as the previous question was also how to support you directly?
Yeah, actually, there are not much possibilities from outside, but from outside of Russia, because when we write posts in social media in Russian, we also ask people to send parcels to pretrial detention center, because it's not limited yet, like in prison then, because in prison there are very few packages you may receive a year. Yeah, and actually about prisoners, yeah, it's only two possibilities: to write letters and to donate to for certain campaigns. Yeah, and also, of course, spreading information is very important, and it's also kind of protection for prisoners and for us also. And about supporting us, first option is financial support. We have Patreon page, or also we know that Patreon offers a lot of fees for people who would like to donate us. So we really happy when somebody organize events in solidarity with us and find some ways to avoid Patreon. Also, yeah, spreading information, calling us to events, also great support.
Thanks a lot for the interview, and a lot of respect for the people in Russia fighting back and or trying the very possible to fight back, and a lot of respect for your work, and thanks a lot of strength for you.
Yeah, from me too.
Thank you, and thank you for invitation.
This is the Final Straw Radio, and now some words from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain. What you say, what you say, what you say, what?
Like 19 people in the U.S. were killed in mass shootings in the month of April 2023. That same month, 107 people were killed by cops, according to an incomplete list compiled by the Washington Post. These are their names: Dwight Cornwell, Erica Jara, Bianca Colon Hernandez, Tyler Raymer, Zachary Scott Polk, James Corey Donald, Eduardo Lee Hoover Jr., Jose Luis Hernandez. Name withheld, April 2nd, Las Cruces, New Mexico. Tadarius Quintez Smith, Michael L. Rogel, Zachary Hoffman, Norman Levine III, Zachary Davis, Roy McGrath, Victor Eduardo Nava, Josh Wayne Tanner, Robert Robbie Dotson, Dontell D. Thompson, Verlin Van Hoy, John Wilburn, Christian Baltazar Torres, Mark Wadsworth, Michael Gann, Romea Tony Spence Jr., Glenn Douglas Perry, LaCorvus Tamar Daly, Ramon Perez, DeAndre Dre Solomon. Name withheld, April 9th, Bruton, Alabama. Name withheld, April 9th, Brookhaven, Mississippi. Edre Toledo Ochoa, Jared Decker, Connor Sturgeon, Felipe Amezcua Manso, Dave Rafael Sanchez, Jamar Vantrell Thompson, Jamal Smith, Brandon Zapata, Richard Ruiz, Matvey Anthony Kilmenko, Zachary Wayne Pace, Stephen Howard Goldstein, David Earl Kingsley, Elmer Lopez Castaneda, Henry Jackson, Daryl Fussell, Cesar Robinson. Name withheld, April 13th, Window Rock, Arizona. Joseph Gilbert Martinez, Jameson Turnbull, Johnny Ray Yamas, Reginald Clay Jr., Brian Nygaard,
William Eric Harver Sr., Joseph Anthony Joey Henderson, Isaiah A. Curtis, Joel Molina Villegas, Jared Romero, Lonnie Earl Cowles, name withheld, April 17th, Alexandria, Louisiana, George Anthony Handley, Jeffrey Allen Martin, Dylan Wallace, Elijah Joseph Valier, Henry Peter Najdeski, Anna Lilia Ortega, Reginald E. Byers Jr., Casey Eric Crowley, Daniel Yester Gabrewin, Dimitri Amarias, Timothy Hardy, name withheld, April 21st, Fairplay, Missouri, William F. Volker, Joseph Anthony Joey Gonzalez, Joseph Jiu-Jitsu Joey Riviere III, Jeremy Shane Brown, Jaime Reyes Hurtado, Michael Kenneth Lee, Robernard Benjamin, Larry Kalk, Joseph Dwayne Taylor, Tracy Hayes, Christopher Ox, Carl Jones, Luke Mendez, Jack James Watson, Thomas Michael Senior, Amaria Henderson, name withheld, April 26th, Missouri City, Texas, Ricky Owen Dowling, Ainsley Stephen David Popwell Jr., Chui Feng Yang, name withheld, April 27th, Bynum, Texas, name withheld, April 27th, Paris, California, Jeffrey Roberts, Michael Owens, Travis L. Bullington, Brian Casillas, Rafael Lopez Leon, Yanitza Arroyo Torres, Buck Larimore, Jonathan Daniel Diaz Duarte, name withheld, April 29th, Orland, California, Ernesto Alonso Flores Jr., Nathaniel Naki, Savannah McCreary. This is Anarchist Prisoner Sean Swain from the Super Duper Uber Mega Ultra Hyper Turbo Multi Maxi Max in Youngstown, Ohio. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can still write Sean at his new old new again address at Sean Swain number A243205 OSP Youngstown 878 Coitsville Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio 44505. You can find his past writings, updates on his case, hear his past audio, find out how to get his books, plus ways to contribute to his legal defense fund at seanswain.org.
This is The Final Straw Radio. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions and suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net or thefinalstrawradio@protonmail.com. If you care to, you can send us letters at TFSR, P.O. Box 6004, Asheville, North Carolina, 28816.